It's Central Time. I'm Rob Farage. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, if you've never invested before, we'll get advice to help you get started or to teach your kids about investing and money management. First, the cost of hearing aids may be on the way down in the future. President Biden signed a broad executive order earlier this month that aims to end anti-competitive practices. It would affect big technology companies, banks, airlines, hospitals, and even hearing aids. Right now, a pair of hearing aids generally cost more than $5,000, and usually, or often at least, they're not covered by insurance. That prices out a lot of people who could use them. In fact, according to the White House, only 14% of the 48 million Americans with hearing loss have them. In 2017, former President Trump signed a bill that would allow hearing aids to be sold over the counter. Biden's order would push regulators to make that happen in 4 months. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you or someone you know use a hearing aid, or are they too expensive? How has hearing loss affected your life or that of a loved one? What do you think of the moves by the federal government in recent years to try to bring the cost of hearing aids down? What questions do you have about how they work or why they cost so much? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Rachel Craig is assistant professor of audiology at UW Stevens Point. Rachel, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thank you for having us.
And Becky Henning is a professor of communication sciences and disorders and director of off-campus audiology clinical education. She also teaches at UW Stevens Point. Becky, thanks for joining us.
Yes, thanks for having us.
Becky, can you take us back a little bit and explain what Congress and President Trump did back in 2017 when it came to hearing devices?
Yeah, was that question for me?
Yeah, Becky?
Yeah. So at that time, the FDA was, you know, had decided to make an over-the-counter, to make regulations for over-the-counter hearing aids that could be sold to people who had potentially mild to moderate hearing loss, especially age-related. Mild to moderate hearing loss, and there were intended to be specific kind of labeling and guidelines for those hearing aids, and that process just hasn't been put in place yet. And so I think President Biden's order is intended to kind of hopefully accelerate that process or get that process going.
And Rachel, as an audiologist, can you talk about the kind of difference that hearing aids can make in people's lives? And I'll say I've got a lot of people in my family who use them. It's probably in my future, I'm guessing, and I've seen before and after. It can really make a big difference, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I basically live and breathe hearing healthcare at this point. You know, hearing aids are not like glasses, though. We don't just put them on and everything is crystal clear and perfect. It takes a lot of adjusting to and counseling and time to get used to it. But once that is done and done appropriately, then, yeah, patients benefit tremendously from hearing aids.
And Rachel, there's been concern, I know, about the idea of over-the-counter hearing aids. I guess the chance of somebody just going in and getting the wrong hearing aid or having a different hearing problem that a hearing aid can't address. What kind of concerns, Rachel, do you think need to be met when it comes to the idea of selling a hearing aid without a prescription?
Absolutely. There are a few concerns. I think the biggest concern is that, you know, hearing loss can be caused by different things. It can be a medical reason that perhaps could be resolved with medical treatment, things like fluid in the middle ear or a hole in the eardrum or even earwax in the ear canal can cause somebody to experience hearing loss. And if those in those particular situations, an over-the-counter hearing aid is definitely not the ideal treatment. That's not going to fix the issue. They're going to need to seek medical treatment, and hopefully that would resolve the issue after that's done. So my biggest concern with over-the-counter hearing aids is that patients will not get the medical treatment that they need, and they'll just go purchase these devices, you know, thinking that it's an age-related hearing loss and that will suffice for treatment. My other concern is that the over-the-counter hearing aids aren't necessarily going to be verified by a hearing healthcare professional. The patient doesn't know exactly what is being put into their ears. And there's potential for damage there if it is in fact too loud. So those are my two biggest concerns. Although I will say, there is a place for them. There are individuals with very mild loss that could benefit from over-the-counter hearing aids.
And Becky, according to the Open Markets Institute, there are just four manufacturers controlling about 84% of the hearing aid market. Do we know, Becky, why there aren't more players involved and so little competition here?
Yeah, that's a good question. There used to be more manufacturers, but there has been consolidation in this industry, as there has been in other industries. Although, over the years, as consolidation has taken place, it doesn't seem like that has sort of directly resulted in increased costs. Hearing aids have always been expensive, even when there were more players involved. I guess I'm not really sure why there are so few right now, but I also don't know that is really the I don't know if that's really the main factor in why they are so expensive. I think a lot of the cost comes from just the technology involved in the devices itself, as well as the professional services that go into the fitting. So I don't know if having more players in the market would make a difference or not.
We're talking about hearing aids, why they're expensive, and a new executive order by President Biden that aims to lower their cost by the goal anyway to get more competition into the market and allow more over-the-counter options without a prescription, though some concerns about that, as you've heard from our guests. Rachel Craig and Becky Henning are with us. Rachel's an assistant professor of audiology at UW-Stevens Point. Becky's a professor of communication sciences and disorders and director of off-campus audiology clinical education, also at UW-Stevens Point. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Are you or someone you know dealing with hearing loss at whatever age? What kind of impact does it have on quality of life? Have you put off, or someone in your family put off, buying hearing aids because of their price? They're pretty expensive, as we're hearing. What questions do you have about how hearing aids work, how they're fit, how they are customized to individual people? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also share your story or your question over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking about hearing aids. An executive order signed by President Biden a couple weeks ago would speed up the time frame for when they can be sold over the counter without a prescription. The idea, the hope anyway, is it would lead to more competition and lower prices. Right now, the average pair costs more than $5,000, oftentimes not covered by insurance. A lot of people who need them don't buy them. Got a couple of professors from UW-Stevens Point staying with us. Becky Henning, professor of communication sciences and disorders and director of off-campus audiology clinical education, and Rachel Craig, assistant professor of audiology. And you could join in with your questions or your experiences at 800-642-1234. Did you or someone you know need a hearing aid but had trouble affording it? Can you talk about before and after? Was a hearing assistance a big game changer in your life or the life of someone you know? Let us know at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. And Becky, I wanted to ask, this might seem like a strange question, but I know sometimes people don't realize they're experiencing hearing loss. It's something that can happen slowly over time. What are some of the warning signs people can watch for in themselves or a loved one that suggests, hey, maybe they should get checked out, get their hearing checked, and see if they need a hearing aid?
Yeah. So you're exactly right that it often happens gradually and people may not notice it. So some classic warning signs, it would be either noticing yourself or a loved one, asking people to repeat themselves more often. The person with hearing loss might still feel like they can
hear, but they might say that people are mumbling all the time. And that's because with hearing loss, people typically lose their hearing first in the higher pitches or higher frequencies and not in other pitches. And so they can still hear, you know, they can still hear the volume. They can still hear that someone's talking, but they're asking that person to repeat themselves more often because they're not hearing all the sounds that person is saying. So it may sound to the person with hearing loss like other people are mumbling. And again, they may be asking for repetition often. They may start to feel kind of fatigued when they're listening to others because they're putting forth a lot of effort that they don't realize they're putting forth to listen. And so, yes, feeling tired when you're having conversations, feeling like they kind of want to withdraw from the conversation and asking for repetition a lot or thinking that other people are mumbling often.
And Rachel, can you talk a little bit about how hearing aids actually work? Because in my head, it's just like an amplifier, but it's, I think, more complicated than that, right?
Yeah, it's much more complicated than that. And I think that's a pretty big misconception. It's not just you. So hearing aids, I kind of like to explain them as a tiny, tiny little computer that you're wearing either in your ears or behind your ears. It's going to take in sound through a microphone, multiple microphones actually, and it's going to process that digitally. Now most hearing aids are digital processed, and the sound is manipulated and then pumped back into the patient's ears. So it's very complex. It's by frequencies, multiple channels and bands that can be manipulated by a hearing healthcare professional and fit appropriately to somebody who has hearing loss.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Victoria is with us in Whitewater. Victoria, hi.
Hi. I've been wearing hearing aids since I was about 45. And I was a substitute teacher, and a little boy kept saying, "What's that word you keep saying to me, pardon?" Because I used to say pardon whenever I couldn't hear kids. And so I had a coworker tell me that I could get them through the Department of Vocational Rehabilitation, and I tried that. So I ended up getting my first hearing aid paid for, and they were life-saving. I have since gone on to buy several more because I cannot live without them. And I did try the kind that just amplified that you buy in stores. I tried those first, and they do not work. So the ones that you go through an audiologist for, oh, my God, they're amazing.
Victoria, thanks a lot for that call. And I've seen actually consumer warnings, Becky, about some of the things that are available in stores or elsewhere that are, like Victoria said, just simple amplifiers, and they're not great for a lot of people. Is that a common experience that Victoria had?
They might be kind of trying to appeal to people, you know, who want something inexpensive, which is absolutely understandable because hearing aids are very expensive. But they often are just a simple amplifier, or they might amplify the low pitches more than the high pitches when most people need the opposite. They need the highs amplified more than the lows. And so that is the reason then behind why, you know, it's a good idea for the FDA to have some, you know, kind of regulations and sort of so we can steer people appropriately, you know, who might benefit from these potential future over-the-counter devices. Because, you know, if it's completely unregulated, then it's easy to end up, you know, purchasing something that is really not the right fit for you. And what we would hope, too, is that if someone tries something over-the-counter and they find that it's not helpful, that then they would, instead of becoming discouraged about sort of hearing aids or amplification in general, that then they would, you know, see an audiologist and make sure that they are fit with something that is appropriate for them.
Victoria, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Let's go now to Al in Green Bay. Al, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. So I'm about 62 years old, and I'm going to go back in the very, very near future and get a second crossover. So I was born deaf in one ear, and probably 15 years ago I had a crossover, which simply means it picks up the sound on my dead ear side, it transmits it to the good ear side, and then, you know, shoots it into your ear. My experience was in a low noise environment, it was super, super helpful. And especially if the person's a little farther away from me, let's say she's a waitress, I'm at the table. If she's on my deaf ear side without the hearing aid, without the crossover, I don't do very well. When I had the crossover, I could hear her much better.
Wow.
My audiologist was awesome. Unfortunately, he's since retired. But he said, look, he said, this is going to be an improvement, but it's not going to be a mountaintop experience. And he was absolutely right about that. And the more you wear them, the better you get at, here's an environment, this is going to help me. I had a minivan, I had middle schoolers in the back, and I could hear the page turn when they would read a book. So that was pretty cool. On the other hand, in a high noise environment, like a sports environment, if you're sitting right up on my right, I'm not going to hear you. But to sit in the office with a hearing professional, and they've got an audio control board on their laptop like you guys would have at WPR, except it's digital. And they would move sliders up and down and adjust different ranges. It, in my experience, definitely worth your time to go to the hearing professional.
Interesting. Thank you. So I hadn't even heard of that, Al, those crossovers. And Rachel, can you talk about some of the different kinds of technology? Because I think a lot of us might picture just what we picture as an old-fashioned hearing aid. Sounds like there's more variety than I knew about.
Yeah, I mean, there certainly is. Hearing aids have come quite a ways. The crossover device that was mentioned, is typically reserved for individuals who have single-sided hearing loss, single-sided deafness. And that is a device, just like he explained, transmits the signal from one side over to the other. And then we have just, you know, the air conduction, the hearing aids that you would think of, the ones that go behind the ear, they still have ones that go in the ear. There's different styles. They all kind of boil down to the same thing, where we have a microphone, some processing, and then a receiver or speaker that puts the sound back into the patient's ear. We also have options for individuals that have what's called a conductive hearing loss. So the issue is not in the inner ear, and it is in the middle ear or the outer ear. And there's surgical options for that as well, where the hearing aid per se is a bone vibrated driven. So it's a medical implant that somebody would wear for that specific hearing loss. So the bottom line is that there are different treatment options out there. It's not just a one size fits all sort of solution, which is why, again, it's really important to go to somebody to get the correct diagnosis for what type of hearing loss, the severity of hearing loss, and then ultimately the most appropriate recommendation.
Thanks a lot for that call, Al, and I'm glad that's working for you at 800-642-1234. We're talking about hearing aids, their cost and effort from the Biden administration and for the previous administration to bring down the costs. Rachel Craig is with us, and Becky Henning, both from UW Stevens Point, audiology experts there. It's still time for your call at 800-642-1234. Becky, what is the cutting edge of hearing assistance technology looking like? Again, personal experience, I had an uncle who had kind of a pilot device where he wore a digital, I don't know, necklace sort of thing, a lanyard almost, and it had these digital processors that filtered in the sounds you wanted to hear, human voices, filtered out background noise. What kind of cutting edge stuff are we seeing on the horizon?
Yeah, I know just what you're talking about there, and we're getting even more advanced than that. Some of the most recent technology is being able to stream directly from phones or other mobile devices, being able to stream audio, you know, phone calls or media straight into the hearing aids. So that would allow someone to, you know, just listen to a phone call through, you know, wirelessly through their hearing aids. So they get the amplification that's customized for them for that phone call or for listening to music or watching videos. And those have been really popular. Some companies are also adding in like motion sensors into the hearing aids to help them, to help them identify, like if someone might be walking or standing still or turning their head, and that can help the hearing aid know where the speech is that it should focus on, versus noise in the background. And there's, again, just all kinds of signal processing technology that it keeps getting improved and is intended to do the best they can to focus on speech and at least attempt to reduce background noise. I mean, with that said, no hearing aid knows exactly what you want to hear and exactly what you don't want to hear. So there's not a hearing aid yet at this time that can only amplify what you want to hear and get rid of everything you don't want to hear. But the technology for reducing noise keeps getting better and better.
Time for one more caller. Herman is with us in Fifields. Herman, hello.
Yes, I think I tuned in a little late, obviously, but I have one question. You know, you can pay $6,000-$7,000 for hearing aids, and I thought, are they really worth it? Is the technology that good?
That's pretty easy to pay that much for a hearing aid. The ones that cost more, Rachel, like, does more expensive mean better, or are they just maybe suited to more particular needs?
Yeah, that's a great question, one that I get fairly often. I mean, prices range based on the clinic, based on location of the clinics. There are typically levels of technology, and the biggest difference between those levels has to do more or less with what the audiologist can do on their side, how much of the processing can we manipulate for the patient. So typically higher end technology is reserved for individuals who just need a lot more of that processing. You know, I picture some of my college students, you know, sophomores in college sitting in big lecture halls, and then they're going to a dining hall, and then they're going back to their dorm, and all of these different varying situations that they find themselves in that they really need amazing signal processing. So those more expensive hearing aids have the ability to process those signals a little bit more accurately. Now, that being said, they're all pretty phenomenal when it comes to sound quality, sound processing. But that's really the biggest difference between kind of the levels of technology within hearing aids.
Thanks for that call. And we'll leave it there. Becky, thanks for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you very much for having us.
And Rachel, thanks for being with us.
Absolutely. Thank you.
We're talking to Becky Henning, professor of communication sciences and disorders and director of off-campus audiology clinical education, and Rachel Craig, assistant professor of audiology, both at UW-Stevens Point. We talked to him today about why hearing aids are expensive, a federal government plan to lower their cost, and some of the basics about how hearing aids work. Coming up after the news, we talk about where to start with investing if you've never done it before and how to introduce investing and other money concepts to kids. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 8 on The Morning Show, Kate Archer Kent and her guests take a look at an often overlooked part of our health and well-being, our feet. That's tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. Now, we often get advice to start saving money and investing early in our lives, but we don't always get advice on how to actually do that. Not all of us have people in our lives who are familiar with the lingo and the ins and outs of how to invest, or we might just feel uncomfortable taking risks on things we don't know a lot about. Our next guest is going to provide a little framework on how to get started investing on your own and how to help your kids understand the concepts around investing and managing money. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about getting started with investing and how to actually do it? What's something you found out the hard way with your own investments? And have you tried to teach some finance lessons, including investing, to your kids? Or do you have questions about how to do that? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. Emily Guy Birkin is a personal finance blogger from Wauwatosa and author of several books, including the forthcoming Stacked, Your Super Serious Guide to Modern Money Management. Emily, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, you write that you had an experience as a kid in class about the value of investing early. And before we get into how to invest, can you remind us of that lesson? How much does it pay off to invest earlier and save earlier rather than later?
Yes. When I was in ninth grade, my social studies teacher had a specific class where we learned about the power of compound interest. And he gave the example of, and it, just by coincidence, he happened to choose me as the early investor. And then a classmate of mine named Joe was the late investor, and saying that if I invested $150 per month starting at age 18 and continuing on until age 40 and then stopped, and then Joe put aside $1,000 per month starting at age 40 and then continued on until he wanted to retire at age 65, assuming a 10% annual return, I would end with almost $1.4 million, even though I only set money aside for 22 years and was only putting $150 a month away, whereas Joe was going to retire at 65 with almost $1.2 million, even though he set aside more for a longer period of time, because that's the power of compound interest. And that stuck with me in part, I'm sure, because I was the example student that Mr. Bosley chose. But also it was just kind of cool. I was like, oh, that's pretty cool math. The problem was, even though my father was a financial planner, and I've always been a money nerd and I've been interested in this, it was one of those where like, okay, that's cool, but how do I get there? How do I do that? You know, right. Like I want to do that, but how?
Right. I dimly recall at age 18, even if I happen to have an extra 100 or 150 bucks lying around and I did want to invest it, I wouldn't have had a clue as to how to do it. So what kind of things are you looking at when it comes to introducing kids to the practicalities of how to actually invest money?
So for me, what I want the kids to understand is that they have some of the information and knowledge that anyone might need to invest. So Warren Buffett very famously says, don't invest in anything you don't understand. And kind of the opposite of it is make sure to invest in things you understand well. So, for instance, my husband is an automotive engineer. He currently works for Harley Davidson. And he has been working with internal combustion engines for his entire career and has been, you know, fascinated by them as a teenager. You know, he is in some ways self-taught, you know, was working on cars as a teenager. So he has a very deep understanding of the automotive industry. And so he can understand how when there's news about regulations, when there's news about a new innovation, how that might affect things like sales, how that might affect the industry as a whole. So he has this very important knowledge that most people don't have that will give him kind of a leg up when it comes to thinking about investing in publicly traded companies. So when it comes to kids, I want them to know you have knowledge too. You know, if you have ever been around a kid who has like very condescendingly explained, no, that's not, that's Charizard, that is not... Jigglypuff, whichever. I do not understand Pokemon. That they have a very deep understanding of things that are important to them. And those things are represented by publicly traded companies. So one of the things that I did with my kids was one day we just for fun, we sat down and we took a dry erase board and we wrote down, like, what are all of your favorite things in the world? What are they? And so they named all kinds of interesting stuff from like ice cream and pizza to things like Pokemon and Batman and Ninja Turtles, Mickey Mouse, the Muppets, swimming. So that was just one day. Then we waited until the next week because we didn't want to overwhelm them and said, okay, pick two each of these and we'll figure out if there is a publicly traded company that this represents. So my elder son picked Pokemon and a show called Pup Academy, which is on the Disney Channel. And my younger son picked toys and Batman. And so we did a little bit of research, you know, who owns Batman, who owns the DC Comics. At the time, it was AT&T, which has since been purchased by Discovery. My older son, Pokemon, he discovered was owned by Nintendo. And then Pup Academy is owned by Disney. In terms of toys, we looked into Mattel toys. And so... with that, we're like, you know a little bit about these things because this is the stuff that you consume. So we are going to buy a share of each of these. So my husband and I are bankrolling it for the kids, but we're going to buy a share of each of these, and we're just going to see what it does. We're going to see what it does, and we're going to think about anything that we might know about these things and how that might affect things. So, for instance, when before AT&T sold DC to Discovery, my older son was in the car with me, and he heard a radio commercial for AT&T phone service, and he got a little offended. He's like, "Hey, they're trying to raise their stock price." And because he was thinking about his brother's investments, and I, you know, tried to explain, well, there's a lot that AT&T does. This is part of what's going on. And, you know, do you think this will affect their stock price? Because this is part of how AT&T works and operates. And so having that conversation with him was kind of giving him that very gentle introduction to what it means to be invested in a company, what a company does, what the kinds of things that a company spends money on, and how that might affect both customers and investors. And so this is the sort of thing where we feel confident about teaching our kids things like how to cook, about teaching our kids how to work on a car, you know, the things that we know something about, and we feel less confident about things like investing. But if we start looking at it as, what's something I know a lot about? What can I, you know, if I buy a single share of that, what can I do with that and see where it goes? And how can we incorporate what I know about this company, what I know about this product into our conversations? That takes down the intimidation level, and it definitely kind of invites the kids to be thinking about things, not just as a consumer, but also as an investor.
Talking to Emily Guy Birkin, personal finance blogger based in Wauwatosa, author of a number of books, including the forthcoming Stacked, Your Super Serious Guide to Modern Money Management. Talking about investing, talking about educating kids about money and investing. You can join in with your questions or maybe what you've done with your kids at 800-642-1234. And Emily, when I was 18, I don't know if you could buy a single share of something. I think I would have had to go to a stockbroker and probably pay a fee. It probably wouldn't have been worth it, I guess. I don't know about when you were 18. Mm-hmm. There are some tools now that allow people to do that, maybe for better or worse. What's out there?
So, yeah, the world has become much more democratized, particularly the world of investing. And so you have apps like things like Robinhood, which I am kind of ambivalent about that app for a number of reasons, because it is more democratized. And so you get to see things like a lot of little guys banding together on something like Robinhood, like they did with the GameStop stock back in the spring of this year, which was amazing to see because it was the power of that kind of democratization versus, you know, hedge funds who are, you know, the big dogs. The problem is, since it's an app, it feels like a game, and a lot of things are gamified. And so it's one of those things where I like to tell people, think of Robinhood like an app or a game with in-app purchases, so that you think real hard before you spend any money in it. But it can be an excellent learning tool if you remember what it is that you're doing with it. And so that's what we're using with our kids, because, again, you can buy just a single share of something using something like Robinhood very easily. So it's this double-edged sword of, you do have this easier entree into the world of investing, but that also means you have an easier entree into the world of investing. So as ever, tread lightly.
And I've also heard, Emily, when kids start making money through their first job or babysitting or whatever, they can do things a little more diversified, like get their first Roth IRA. Is that something worth bringing kids into when they're old enough to actually be making a little bit of money?
Yes, absolutely. Now, for one thing, getting kids starting to invest in their retirement is going to be huge, because even if all you do is put aside $10 every couple of months into a Roth IRA, if you're doing that with a teenager, the amount of time, you've got 50 years for that money to grow. And so that's that lesson that my social studies teacher was trying to show us when I was in ninth grade. And so that can be a huge thing. And then particularly because of Roth IRAs, the way those work is you put money in that has already been taxed. kids are not going to be in a situation where they need to worry about high tax rates because, you know, they're working after school jobs, they're working summer jobs. If they are going to owe any taxes whatsoever, it's not going to be a lot. So you put that money in and then it grows and you take it out tax-free in retirement. The difference between your tax bracket when you're a 17-year-old and your tax bracket when you're a 67-year-old is going to be huge. So you are going to be helping your kids out in two different ways, both with the investing and with the potential tax savings. And so that's something that a lot of people just, it doesn't occur to you. I mean, it's, you don't think about retirement when you're 15. You don't. It's hard to think about college savings when your child's a newborn. But doing that kind of thing early on, and even just a little bit, just saying like, hey, you know, you got paid $500 over the summer. How about $25 goes into your Roth IRA? I mean, it doesn't sound like much, but let it sit for all that time. It's going to make a big difference.
We're talking to Emily Guy Birkin, personal finance blogger from Wauwatosa, author of personal finance books. Talk about how to get started with investing and how to introduce concepts of investing and money management to kids. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. If you already invest, how did you get started? Have you worked with kids on lessons about money, especially on investing? Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. The conversation continues coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Emily Guy Birkin about investing for beginners, especially introducing kids to concepts related to investing. Emily's a personal finance blogger from Wauwatosa, author of a bunch of personal finance books, including an upcoming one called Stacked, Your Super Serious Guide to Modern Money Management. Let's go to your calls now at 800-642-1234. Steve is with us in La Crosse. Steve, hi.
Hey, thanks for taking my call, and thanks for doing this, Emily. I appreciate it. This really falls into a perfect question that I had. So I have a son that's 11, and probably since he was like 8 or 9, we've talked about investing and compounding interest, and he's like super interested in it. He works really hard. I told him once he saves $1,000, which is taking him a while to get there, but that's like all of his birthday money, the money that he earns in the summer, that we would invest it. I've sadly have not been able to find sort of a program that he can invest it into, that he can log in and watch it grow. You know what I mean? Something that's really geared towards kids, something that would like really get them interested in it and excited for it. I know we've talked about doing a Roth IRA, but that seems really plain, probably the best way to go. But is there any investment company that has something like this that kids can get involved with it? Because that would really, I think, would spur their interest on wanting to put more money into it and then in turn, hopefully make them a miser of money.
Interesting, Steve. Mm-hmm. Thank you so much for sharing that that question. Emily, what do you think?
That is an excellent question, and I'm afraid I don't know anything off of the top of my head that is specifically geared towards kids. I do know that there are, you know, a number of banks and other things will have things like savings accounts for kids and trying to teach them in that way. And the other option that I have seen, there are some places where you can get like beautiful stock certificates of certain companies. So like I know Disney for one, that are frameable. And that's another thing that sometimes people will do as a gift for a child. Like, you know, I bought you a stock in Disney and there's, you know, the regular stock, but then there's this beautiful frameable stock certificate that's got the, you know, the swoopy D and all of that. So I think one of the things that we as parents can do is find ways to make it exciting for them, even if there isn't necessarily an app specifically for it. And, you know, there very well may be but, you know, as I mentioned with Robinhood, sometimes apps can be a double-edged sword. But something that we are doing with our kids is we have a weekly meeting every week where we kind of just talk about here's what we're planning for the next week, so the kids will know, you know, when their swim lesson is, you know, if there's a dentist appointment coming up, that sort of thing. And we've incorporated the investing into our weekly meeting where we just kind of look, see how things are doing, and we keep a notebook where we write it down. We're hoping to eventually, we just have not gotten around to it, to have a board where we can track things in the same way that when my husband and I were first married, we got very excited about paying off debt because we had a debt thermometer up in our kitchen and we couldn't wait to color it in. Kids are the same way. I mean, so giving them something that even if it's not necessarily in an app with the lights and colors and all of that, you can find a way to make it really exciting with hey, this is what I'm invested in. It's on my wall. Either, you know, you've got that stock certificate or you've got the chart that you're building together with each time you check in on how your investments are doing. And then that kind of DIY method of doing it could be a really nice way to work together and get excited about it together.
Thanks for that call, Steve. We'll go now to Jackie with us in Milwaukee. Jackie, hello.
Hi. You mentioned about investing in something you're knowledgeable and interested in and you keep up with, but yet I wouldn't know what to do with it. I've always been kind of under the thing that with investments, you buy and you stay in it a long time, because if I hear something, I don't want to be buying and selling every time I hear something that sounds either positive or negative.
Interesting, Jackie. Mm-hmm. Yeah, buy and hold or play the market and respond to each news up and down tick.
That's an excellent question. And yes, absolutely. I am a big believer in buy and hold. And that's one of the things where rather than using your knowledge to try to time the market in terms of selling it, it's going gangbusters now, but something bad's coming down the line, let's sell it now. It's more along the lines of, you know, if you have an idea of something exciting coming down the line, that's when to buy. But that's the only way that I think is helpful to time the market, is if you I know there's this new technology coming that's going to change this. Or one of the things I remember very vividly when Jurassic Park came out in the 1990s, we knew it was coming. And my dad said something about now would be the time to invest in anything dinosaur related. and so with what I'm trying to do with my children and kind of the point of why I want them to invest in something they know is that they can understand how the stock market works, understand what it means to be invested, and understand what the relationship between what happens in the world, what happens with consumers, what happens with news, what happens with new innovations, and how that affects investors. So it's not necessarily teaching them how to time the market, because that's a worthy goal. Timing the market is another form of gambling, in my opinion. But it's really more about the being able to look at the patterns and see, hey, this is how this happened. This is what happened to our money when that happened. And so they will feel more confident and comfortable with the market and feel like this is something they can do.
Thanks a lot for that call. In our last minute or so, Emily, I know some young investors are interested in the new cryptocurrencies, the blank coins out there. When it comes to that idea of investing in things you understand, what do you think of that?
Cryptocurrency worries me specifically for that reason, just because a lot of the people who invest in it don't necessarily understand it. And it's in the same way that the dot-com bubble in the late 90s, people were like, computers, they're great, without really understanding computers. So when it comes to things like crypto, when it comes to any the best new thing down the block and you can't lose, and there are these people who started with $100 and now they're millionaires, it's always important to go, what am I reacting to? Am I reacting to this because I think it's a good idea, that I like the idea of you know, this blockchain, something that is not related to government, that is completely free of regulation? Am I reacting to what it actually is, or am I reacting to the stories about it, about someone who managed to do something incredible with it because they understood it? And so asking yourself that question can help you separate the, you know, exciting opportunities that you should look into and the exciting opportunities that you should just let pass by.
Emily, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us again.
Thank you for having me.
That's Emily Guy-Birkin, personal finance blogger from Wauwatosa. Her upcoming book is called Stacked, Your Super Serious Guide to Modern Money Management. She joined us to talk about investment lessons for kids. Read more of her work. We've got a link at WPR.org/Central Time. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, the pandemic raised concerns about mental health, but a psychologist tells us it also demonstrated how robust and resilient we can be. And on Food Friday, it's slaw. I'm looking forward to it. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Here's a new trend that may or may not be a trend. I need some more information, and parents, you can help me out. According to the Wall Street Journal, a number of parents of young children in the United States report that their children have started speaking with a British accent and actually mixing in some phrases more common in the UK than the US, asking for biscuits instead of cookies, referring to the stop at the petrol station instead of the gas station, and asking if they can turn on the telly. And that last one is the culprit. According to parents interviewed in this story, the accents are coming from the popular show for young children, Peppa Pig. It airs on Nick Jr., as far as I can tell. Videos available on YouTube, I assume one streaming service or another. My kids are a bit old for it. So here's where you come in. Parents of younger children, do your kids watch Peppa Pig? And have you noticed an accent or some Britishisms creeping into their conversations? Let us know. Email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Or you can tweet us at Central Time WPR, at Central Time WPR on Twitter. Confirm or deny this trend. Hopefully we'll get a truck full of responses. Sorry, Lori full. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.